Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Josh Brown, you're back.
I am so croaky still, Scott Telford. You'd think I'd eaten a frog. I'm so pleased to be back. I was ill last week.
You just had a random thing that wiped you off like a whole week.
It's every time
Wouldn't let you go.
I go visit the parents and I come back just destroyed physically. I was wiped out. You know, I thought it was going to be just a little cold. And then I was in bed all day, every day. And I couldn't turn my head because my head would get dizzy and it would get light and it would hurt a lot. Uh-huh. And it was one of those colds. I was texting you at the weekend about this. You know, sometimes when you're kind of off work ill, and no one likes being ill.
No.
But sometimes it might come after a period of, you know, big stress at work or something. So you're just kind of, in a weird way, just pleased to be off.
Yes.
I wasn't pleased to be off last week. I was raring to go. I had the wind-up sorted. I had the news I was going to do on Monday.
Uh-huh.
I had everything planned. I had a double espresso Sunday morning, and I felt like I could destroy the world. I felt on top of
it. You sent me a flex photo.
I was like, here
he is.
I was wearing a vest.
Yeah.
I had me, I finally figured out me eating routine. I just, things were in place.
Uh-huh.
On Sunday morning, and by Sunday night, things were out of place, and they've been out of place ever since. But I
think I blamed that double espresso. It slapped you around.
I had a double espresso, and I had the mankiest fish and chips you've ever had.
Don't have any manky fish, mate.
It was gross, man. The fish was grey. The chips were tasteless.
Where I don't want to call up any place out. Which region was this from?
It was my hometown.
Right.
And they're normally really reliable there, and they weren't good. So I'm blaming the fish and chips.
That's fair.
Not ideal. But I'm back, and I've got so much to talk to you about that I've been saving up in my horrible little sack for the past 2 weeks.
Well, tip that sack out, my friend. We made a collection of notes. The only thing that I wrote down was hell divers over and over again. But we do have very many notes to get to. And this is the wind-up. I should have said that before. I'm Scott Telford. That is Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Telford.
Hello, hello. Where we get through whatever's going on in the gaming industry, whatever talking points are happening, which is to say hell divers is the one.
Is this?
The new PAL world.
Oh,
you might say.
Don't call it that. Don't make me not want to play it. Tell me all about Helldivers 2, because I've heard nothing but praise from every single person in this office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's hilarious, because a week before Helldivers came out, no one except Ewan Paterson was asked about it.
No, you got to shout out Ewan Paterson. You got to give him his flowers. Man was celebrating the idea of Helldivers 2 months in advance. And I remember him saying to us, like, I feel like there's something here. There's something to this game. And me and him did a podcast last week about it as well. All the news about it. I'd record a lot. Me and him talked about it at some point last week. And he was the only person who saw it. I don't even believe Sony saw this coming. Arrowhead, the developers themselves, have now thrown out their plans for the rest of the year to overhaul what they're going to be doing for the rest of 2024. Helldivers 2 is just amazing. If you have a PlayStation, you should play. I love that the price for it is half of what a traditional first-party game is, or a traditional Sony game is, PlayStation game is. And it's just awesome. I only wanted to touch on it because I get that it's a big old talking point, and me and Ewan's video was just an excuse to gush about the game anyway, because it has proven a lot of people wrong in regards to that conversation on what people want from an exclusive game, that expectation of cinematics or storytelling or whatever. And it's just such a gameplay-forward game. It reminds me so much of Gears 2 Horde mode or Gears 3, playing Halo 2 online, talking to randoms when Xbox Live was new. Like, I've not talked to randoms in like 15 years. But the thing is, like, all of this is to say that Helldivers 2 has reignited that part of me that loved online chat in multiplayer games.
Yeah.
It was that pre-Call of Duty Modern Warfare golden era where, there was some horrific stuff said, but there was some phenomenal co-op moments in there too. And you made friends friends with someone from a different country or a different wing of your country or whatever. It was a beautiful time, damn it. And like, I'm back in it at the minute. And so the other day, I was just talking to these randoms. We were coordinating. We're loading each other's guns. Like Helldivers 2 has that, has a whole thing where certain weapons are better if you work as a team of two.
Yeah.
And like that stuff's great. Some of the mission goals, you need to talk to each other to align a satellite or whatever it is. And there's not very many of them, but those little things work really, really well. And it's just such a reminder of like, we are more when we come together, when we dive together. I love it.
You know what, man? I was similarly re-embraced online multiplayer with friends and with strangers over the pandemic with Warzone, as I've mentioned before. You know, that was what got my band back together. Yeah. It got us an excuse to log on, shoot the crap, and then log back off. And I love that Helldivers has
don't
been
log off, mate. Just keep playing.
Catalyst for you. I did for like 500 hours, and then they nuked Verdansk, and then I couldn't go back, so that's a shame.
That's
but
fair.
Helldivers 2, I also, we got some codes in, and I was going to play it over the first weekend. Ewan got one code, I got a code, and I haven't really had time to go on it yet, because you need that squad as
you
far
do,
as
you
I
do,
can
you
tell
do.
And obviously I was not very well, didn't want to go on the headset or anything, so I need to etch out some time for Ewan and whoever else to show me the ropes.
Yeah, I will say that it's fun enough to play solo. Sometimes the mission designs kind of screw you over because it's just the sheer reality of how many enemies you're up against. However, if you do happen to do a solo mission, there is like a really good like survival edge to that, especially with how atmospheric the music is, and you're aware that you're like the last soldier left behind, and you can see everyone dropping around you and kind of stuff. But at the same time, yeah, it is good for a squad. You kind of do need to match up. The game servers have taken an absolute hammering over the weekend. Arrowhead got out there and said they were doing 1.5 times XP for the weekend as an apology for the servers being spotty towards the end of last week, which only made people dive in even more. The game has now surpassed GTA 5's concurrent player count. It's the most played PlayStation game on Steam by a considerable margin.
Yeah.
I think God of War was what it was before, but that was about 70,000 concurrents. This is now over 400,000. It's ridiculous. But at some point, they had to cap the servers. You literally had updates from various team members at Arrowhead saying they're doing as much as they can. They're going without sleep. They're trying to make it work. Late on Sunday night, they just had to put a server cap on, so it became one in, one out. And when you load the game up, because I tested this on Sunday night, you just get a warning saying, we literally can't let you in. The club is full.
It's crazy.
Yeah, queuing down the streets to get in.
One in, one out for a video game. I love that, man.
I mean,
that's my
paraphrase, but it is what they've done. Like, but still, it's worth just saying that just giving the game its flowers. Like, that was the video that me and Ewan did last week. And shout out to just the entire team. Like, this is phenomenal. It's been in development for a long time. 2015 was Helldivers 1. And it's just a game that a lot of people should check out. I think that it's really fascinating just seeing what they're going to do. And the storytelling that's in here, quote-unquote storytelling, is like metatextual stuff, where it's like you're looking after the galaxy as a collective. And they've done a great job of putting fake news reports out on Twitter, just saying like, you guys have all taken over this planet, but the automatons are invading, so go over here. And it's like, this is really cool.
It's an interesting approach, I think, to a live service and sort of online multiplayer generally, to have that meta framing. I like it when, you know, the stories are implemented in that way. I think you've seen so many games try to do that over the years and not quite nail it. My first thought goes to the original Titanfall, which was sold on the idea that it was a multiplayer-only game, but we have this single player, we have this world that you want to get invested in. And we've seen that fail so many times, and yet Helldivers, after the success of the original, because I imagine a lot of it was just carried over in terms of the story and the context and stuff, but it's just, it seems to have nailed it. It seems to know exactly what it is, and it seems to be confident in its presentation.
Yeah, I don't know if you can think of anything for this, but my mind was trying to think of any third-person shooters of a certain production level. Like, you got Gears 5 in, like, 2019 or 18.
Yeah.
But, like, the third-person shooter space is empty for the vast majority, and I wonder if it's that to a degree. Like, I don't think anyone other than you and Pass saw this coming at all, to this degree.
Not to this
like,
degree,
like,
to
outpace GTA 5 and some of the top titles on Steam. The only thing it's behind now is Counter-Strike.
Yeah.
And that has, like, multiple millions of players and stuff. But, yeah, I was trying to think of, like, anything else that's tried to come in and do a really good third-person shooter. We just haven't really had it. It's kind of an abandoned space. There's so much conflation of third-person shooters and cover shooters that they became the same thing. And, you know, we had so many different games when Gears was big, but Gears 5 was fine enough, but it didn't like set off a whole wave of copycats. Like, to some degree, these are the numbers of people who just want to play a third-person shooter.
No, you mentioned it. Like, a pure action third-person shooter, it has been a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to recall, like, my mind goes back to Resi 4 from last year, but that's survival horror, mm-hmm. same with Dead Space. And I've not played barely anything of Helldivers 2, but even I felt like I was getting a kick of something really good just playing through the tutorial and it feeling so fluid mm-hmm. and smooth. It almost reminded me of the Fox Engine in Metal Gear Solid 5 and the way that you were going from, I don't know, a sprint to prone to crawling on your belly and you, it just all kind of worked in that way. I don't think we've really had anything like that since maybe Control.
Well, that's the thing, right? It's like, yeah, there are obviously tons of third-person games with shooting elements in them, but if you think of something as pure as Gears of War, like, that idea of just giving you a really good, tactile third-person shooter that is so immediate. Like, there is so little story. Like, you're a Helldiver, there's a bunch of bugs, go kill, defend the galaxy. Like, there's very little to it. There's lore bits of text files you can find on the planets to find a bit of history about the particular planet that you're on, but it's so gameplay forward that I love that about it. I think as well, I don't talk too much more about it because it just is the game right now, but I do think it's worth shouting out that every aspect of it is just so refined, like in regards to ammo clip sizes, and if you reload too early you lose the rest of your ammo clip, you need to think about that stuff. Aiming down sights is a toggle, but like if you're aiming in general you need to make sure you're crouching so that it comes together. You have two reticles.
I like,
it's
like that.
Yeah, and it's like you can then, but you can do that to your advantage if you sort of turn like a 90, like turn about 90 degrees and then keep firing. As your gun catches up you'll spray across the whole, like an arc kind of thing, and it's like loads of little things like that, and like the way extractions happen, the fact that friendly fire is on, the fact that those certain weapons need to be fired with two people or whatever it is, all those little systems, for as much as we didn't really hear much about Helldivers 2, feel like they've been playtested like to perfection.
Yeah.
Like there's almost nothing wrong with it at all. Like it's, you really can't find a flaw. Like you could point to some of the customization. I would like some more customization, but it's like there's still a ton in there. And then even the monetized side of it, which like I'm quite staunch on, if you're charging an upfront cost, you can't then have a free to play model from launch.
Yeah.
I get it for the developers on a long enough timeline as a way to pay those people. So I am quote unquote against that. But I think if you're gonna have that in there, at least their prices are extremely low and fundamentally optional. The only thing the premium currency is going towards is the store that rotates, and for the most part the stuff in there has been pretty naff anyway. It's just aesthetics as well, it's not anything, you're not paying to win or anything.
No.
So there is also a battle pass, but still, like, you can earn premium currency in game as well, so if you want to grind it out to get that stuff you just can. It's like there's a palatability to it that like most games like this would just nickel and dime you. And I'm gonna pivot into Rick.
No, don't you dare, don't you do that to me. You had not pivoted it into Rick Grimes. Look, because Rick Grimes does not nickel and dime you either.
He's worth every penny,
he's
apparently.
Worth every penny of the Call of Duty Battle Pass. I'll have you know, he's definitely worthy of that investment. Oh, I can't believe you've done this to me.
We'll get to them. We'll get to him in a little bit. But it is in that climate of like that big sort of you know, live service expectations, microtransaction expectations. It's not to forgive or want this anywhere else. But still, if you're going to do it and you've been in development for this long, this is our way to do it. That is. So far been received very well.
You know what, man, a game like this makes us look like idiots in the best possible way, because I remember before it was coming out, and we might have done a podcast or maybe like a February prediction sort of video where we were looking at Helldivers 2, and I think a lot of us, not just us two, were asking the question of why isn't it on PlayStation Plus?
I was totally one on PS Plus.
It would get like this massive player base. It could be free to play, maybe, and get people into the ecosystem. And I think like the sales success of it is kind of just proven why it wasn't. Like, if you have confidence in your product and your product is good and you can get that sort of word of mouth appeal on a high quality thing, like you can make the most of that exclusivity or that launch or whatever it is.
I would be fascinated by that conversation, because I think it's a happy accident in that regard. I think it was in development for so long, it's, you know, it's ready to come out. It's Helldivers. It's a known IP to a point, but your average person probably hasn't heard of it. I think it slipped under the radar, and then it blew up. It was like Niantic with Pokemon Go, where Nintendo were just like, oh, it's over there. Oh, my God, it's the biggest thing ever. All right, okay, we should probably talk about it. Like, I just feel like overall, the fact that they've been able to put the hiring thing out and they've changed their plans and everything, I don't think Sony were thinking that much about it.
No.
Because their overall approach to live service stuff is caught up in all the Jim Ryan, Hiroki Totoki leadership changey stuff. And Foam Stars got way more marketing.
Yeah, it did.
which we'll get to. But Foam Stars is the one that the spotlight was shone on. Helldivers was just kind of left to the side. As opposed to them going like, this is so quality, we know it's going to blow. I don't think they knew at all.
No.
But the quality is there, and that's what's blown up. As opposed to, at least I would say, Foam Stars, which is a good pivot. You've been playing the old Foam Stars.
Here's the thing, because I was not interested in Foam Stars.
Yep.
But then you said, as so many people have said, that it's pretty much just Splatoon.
I can see the blade.
And it is. It undoubtedly is Splatoon. But the thing is, I've not played Splatoon, right? And I'm not going to pay for Splatoon.
No.
Because I don't really play online multiplayer on my Nintendo Switch. So, Foam Stars released on the PlayStation Plus premium service, and I thought I could go for a bit of that. I could jump in, see what all the fuss is about. It also helped that the last few trailers genuinely did a lot for me. I thought it looked really pretty.
The music's awesome.
The music is awesome. Graphically, it has a presentational style that I vibe with a lot. There's something about... I know it's surprising, isn't it? Because...
It's so Fortnite-y to me. I know that's an overused umbrella term.
I wasn't even going to criticize that. I can see why you would say it's Fortnite-y, but here's the thing. I like the way Fortnite looks as well.
True.
I think Fortnite has something about it. Whether that thing is Unreal Engine 5, I don't know. Mm. But it's colorful, it's cohesive, more importantly, and it feels confident in its presentation.
True.
And I don't love Foam Stars as a game, but its presentation kind of had that as well. I was looking at these, you know, silky, pristine arenas and this kind of like neon future cyberpunk thing they have going for themselves. Mm. And it just worked. There are so many games out there that kind of go for the game show aesthetic that I find really cringy at times and just really unappealing. And for whatever reason, I don't get that here. Like, there's the foam and the colors. It all just blends together to create something that works for my eye for whatever reason. So
that's fair.
When I jumped in and kind of realized it played quite well, too.
It does.
I was here for it, man. I think it's a soulless product in many ways. The outrageous microtransaction store in there is just ridiculous. You know, you could say, yeah, it's on PlayStation Plus, but they're charging like £40 for skins. And
£40.
And they're not even good skins.
No.
And, you know, I don't know who is paying for those things, but okay. But like the actual core gameplay, which pretty much is just Splatoon across a few different game modes, is funny enough to capture my imagination and become my casual game, because I love just jumping on something for a match or two.
Same.
But the only other game I can really do that with is Call of Duty, and Call of Duty requires way too much brain attention.
Hell effing divers.
Well, here's the thing. I also like to not speak to people at all.
There's a ping system in there, my friend.
I feel like you need to coordinate a little bit in Helldivers, whereas in Foam Stars, I can just be my little guy on my little surfboard shooting out foam and trying to win a match. It really scratches that casual element that I really want. It's the most casual multiplayer game I've ever played. I'm not playing it concerned about performance necessarily, not concerned about kills or chills, as they're known in this game.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I'm just concerned about having 5 minutes of fun. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how much I missed that or needed it in my gaming repertoire. But the Foam Stars is providing me with it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, yeah, I agree. Like, I always think of those games, I call them bridging games. It's like, if I'm on the way to another big game, I'll bridge by having a match or two in something else. But then it's Tekken 8 and I play it for a month solid and I can't get on the main story thing. But yeah, like, Foam Stars does play very well. When I mentioned the art style being Fortnite-y, I meant in terms of being derivative. Like, just, you can tell what they're pulling from.
Yeah.
This game feels like a hit and run. I feel like I'm hit and they are sprinting. Like, it's just the amount of money in those microtransactions is insane. The amount of Splatoon in the overall game's design is insane. It just feels very cynical. And it's like, there are some distinct things in regards to the gameplay. I like that you have to knock players out by skating into them. That's fun. And if your teammate hits you, they save you. That's cool, because you're in like a phased, a dazed state. And also, like, if you spray a bunch of foam, it piles up, so you can argue that it's changing the geometry as the match plays out.
Yes.
My big issue with it was the sheer readability of combat, like the amount of foam that gets in the way, the amount of times you're just shooting through walls of foam, explosives, whatever it is, just like trying to get a bead on a player, and you still hit them, you still get the kill, but it's like, or the chill. The fact that they call it chills is like, oh my God, just don't. But like, there's that. But that whole readability of combat was the thing that made me go, like, I'm good.
Thing is, right, and I mean this in the nicest way, and I don't want to insult you anyone listening to this, because I play this game too. But I think what's important to remember, in a way, And this is a criticism as well.
Yes.
This game is for babies, right? The game is for babies.
Babies haven't got £40 to spend.
That's where the criticism comes in, right? I think aesthetically, it's definitely going for a really young audience. It's going for probably sub Fortnite because, you know, it's very much the language it uses, even in substituting kill for chill and stuff.
Yeah,
it's so wrapped in bubble wrap, right? And I think I don't have a problem with that. I'm okay with the cringe that comes from that because it's not for me. You know,
no, I like them building a world, yeah.
But that, I think, makes the microtransaction side of it more ghoulish and more worthy of criticism because it's for babies, it's for kids, it's for this young audience and they're kind of being treated with kid gloves as they should. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they've got this store that has a bunch of £40 skins in it.
Yeah.
And that is designed to get their serotonin going and get them feeling like they're missing out if they don't have the latest skins and stuff. And that's where I have a problem with it being for that market rather than the language of it at the presentation.
No, I'd back that. I'm all for like a custom nomenclature. I'm all for like a custom universe. It's just that it just feels so derivative and it just feels so cringy. And you literally have, whenever we, at least in our office, do a joke about like the I don't know, some sort of press announcement. It's like, hey guys, the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And we do like a stupid voice. Your tutorial guy talks like that. Like, and it's just, it could have, if you went one step further, it would be Helldivers-ing it where you're aware of the stuff you're pastiching because they play it so straight and it's like we call them chills guys and it's just kind of so cringe and so on the nose and so nakedly putting Splatoon on another platform.
Yeah.
And not to make everything about Palworld, but like you look at Palworld as putting Pokemon on other platforms and it blew up and you can see the potential where like you put a game like Splatoon, which is Splatoon 2 and Splatoon 3 are phenomenal.
Yeah.
You put that on other platforms, those mechanics, that idea of inking part of the world and everything else, you do that somewhere else and it makes a ton of money.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that was the mission statement from the beginning and the end. It's not that the devs didn't care. Like I said, I really like the music in it. But at the same time, it's Persona music. It's
right.
Been done somewhere else in regards to a thing you can point at and be like, they brought that in.
The thing is, you're absolutely right. You're spot on about everything you just said. All the criticisms, I agree with. It's just a strange one because I would never support this as kind of a product, if that makes sense. I would never encourage everyone listening to this podcast to go out and play it.
No.
It's just hit at a time where it's the exact niche that I was after because there are so few, I think anyway, like super casual but super impactful multiplayer games. Like everything that I would play as one of those bridging games that you described are far better games than this, but I can't turn my brain off in the same way. Like I'm getting absolutely slapped by skill-based matchmaking in Call of Duty, or I jump into something like Rocket League, which has a casual element, but
that was mine for years.
You might get absolutely annihilated by these high IQ players, right? Like the ceiling is so high, and sometimes I kind of just want to go on, turn my brain off for 5 minutes while my tea is cooking.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This scratches that itch. As a wider product, I think it's nefarious the way it rolls out of its microtransaction store.
Uh-huh.
And as a product, it has all of the soulless elements that you just described because it is just blatantly taken from a bunch of other sources and going, what if we just roll all these popular things together and hopefully have a live service? I don't think it'll be alive more than 3 months, but those 3 months, I will log on at least twice more and I will have two more decent games.
I think that's my thing with the hit and run side of it is like you're only, to me, you're cranking those microtransaction prices because you know you're not going to be around for very long.
Yeah.
Like Square Enix also published the Avengers game, which in its dying throws had insanely overpriced DLC. It was like $150 for the movie skins or whatever it was. They will try and fleece the living hell out of the people who are willing to stick around for it and get involved in that marketplace. But yeah, at least it plays well. You can't ignore all that stuff and just go in and be like, are there a good set of gameplay systems? Yes, for the most part. However, I would say that it's almost unintelligible in regards to aiming at players the more that stuff kicks off. But also, I have a direct comparison to Splatoon, which just does everything so much better.
Yeah, well, that's probably it, right? I didn't have a problem with the readability of the map itself.
Just when you're targeting, like, can you see the dude you're shooting?
Yeah,
I have walls of foam. I was like, I'm just shooting at, like, an icon.
That is true. You are shooting at an icon in, like, all of the enemies have a visible silhouette when they're behind cover or they're behind the foam. So it's like, yeah, you're not really shooting at a person. You're shooting at the outline of a person or whatever. But that worked for me because of the visual splendor of it and the just thrill of skating around that foam felt phone. I think it's For what it is, it's incredibly low stakes, and I appreciate that. I feel like I will never have to spend a single penny on this game, and I don't think you necessarily should in its current state. And that's shouldn't be championed, but it's better than what Square Enix has done recently.
Yeah, I'd
rather play this than the Avengers.
Oh, yeah. I just don't want to play either of them. I think I'll take Splatoon. It's like you said, for Square Enix, it's better. It's better than the things they've done in the past. But we'll see how it rolls out. I'll be amazed if it's still here this time next year.
Me too.
Like my beloved Knockout City got knocked out itself. Like that was, I played Rocket League for like 6 years, and then I went to Knockout City was my bridging game, and then Knockout City failed as well. So I also don't have that little bridging game thing apart from something like Helldivers or a couple of rounds on Tekken.
There you go.
I do want to throw in, because we've got lots of things to get to, the Rick Grimes Call of Duty skit.
Yeah, this is going to be very brief.
Confession time.
We got a question on the UBP when me and you did an episode a few weeks ago, and someone was asking, has a piece of DLC or an add-on ever gotten you back into a game? And they mentioned the Rick Grimes Walking Dead crossover for Call of Duty, and that was the first time I'd heard of this, which is surprising considering both those things I love. And my answer is yes, that has got me back in, because
did you buy it?
Well, here we go. I immediately logged back on to Call of Duty Warzone to see this crossover. And initially, they only have Rick Grimes in there. I don't think he's voiced by Andrew Lincoln. They might have taken some lines from the show, but sometimes the voice sounds a little bit off. Because they've got a new Walking Dead show starring Rick Grimes and Michonne coming out in a few weeks. And he, thankfully, wasn't a separate $16.99 purchase. You get his skin straight away if you get the battle pass. I already had enough COD points to buy the battle pass without spending any real money, so I didn't technically pay for him. I think the thing that's worth noting, though, is I would have paid for him if he wasn't in the battle pass.
No.
But I didn't have to, so I'm pleased I didn't. And how you know what? The model's not even that good.
It's good.
The Michonne one's really good. Like, it's spot on. But the Rick one's like, it's a little weird.
£17.
I'd have spent it, yeah. I
would. How much fast food you could get for that?
You can probably only get like one big McDonald's takeaway for that.
£17 of fast food would be a lot of fast food.
I'm getting it from delivery, though. I have to pay the delivery fees.
I can't.
The driver.
I can't sanction this buffoonery. I remember when skins were like, you know, $2.95, and even that was egregious. My little pin for my little PlayStation jacket was like $1.99 in PlayStation Home, and I thought that was insane.
Here's the thing. You don't just get the skin, Scott.
Go on.
You get some tracer bullets, so your gun might fire a specific color, or it might dismember a specific way, and you get some stickers, and you get some other stuff that you don't want, but it's all there, baby.
Custom dismemberment I'm more into. If you can give me, I don't really want to pay extra for it, but if I can kill a player in a way that they know they got killed by me because their limb flew up out their mouth or something, I'm fine with that.
That's what I got when I bought the Ash Evil Dead bundle. You got an AK that dismembered a specific way, I think. or maybe it didn't, and it bloodied itself the more close you got. It's
you
gross.
Bloodied you bloodied yourself doing
I
this.
Know when you, I really did. I've disgraced myself. I have nothing more to add to that other than the fact that it happened. And I wanted it to be better.
Right.
Put it that way. I'm looking forward to the Michonne one. I'll pay for that one as well. And then I won't even be able to watch the show, hilariously, because it doesn't have a UK distributor at the minute. Not only spin-offs do, which is amazing. So I've got a spin-off, kind of like, I'm going off on a weird tangent now, but the Activision crossovers recently have been mad. In November of last year, we got the Dune 2 crossover, because that was when that movie was originally supposed to come out. But because it was delayed, you just had like playable Dune characters.
I thought you said Doom.
Oh, no, sorry. Dune. D-U-N-E.
That would have got me running in.
It would have. There was a Doom crossover, though, as well. But that's by the by.
What the hell?
Actual Dune. Yeah, they had the crossover out when the movie wasn't out. So it was like, well, what's going on here, lads? What's happening? And this kind of feels similar because, the show is coming out this month, thankfully. But it's only coming out in America this month. So international players are like, what? Why are you doing a Walking Dead crossover after the show is over? It just doesn't translate on that international level. Strange, isn't it?
I don't know what Call of Duty is anymore.
No one does.
Nicki Minaj is in there, apparently.
I'd buy that skin as well.
Stop buying the skins.
Seeing Nicki Minaj in Call of Duty.
No,
I
you
also want to get. I would have got the Dune one because you get Timothy Chalamet.
Do you get that little box that he puts his hand in?
Maybe. I'm not sure. Maybe that's a charm.
Box DLC.
He looks really good, though, in the game.
He's going to look good anyway.
That
but
is
you
true.
Don't have to pay 17. Just Google image.
I know, but.
He wouldn't want you to do it.
I'll put it towards Tekken instead.
Yes! For the love of God, you've got Prince of Persia, you've got Tekken 8, you've got Infinite Wealth. They're all right there.
Hey, I've got something nice to talk to you about.
Please do.
It was my 9th What Culture anniversary a few weeks ago. And this was a strange, I had a strange little coincidence with this because I was at a gig. I was going to see, I've just completely derailed the podcast.
No, do
now,
it.
And I'm
gonna we had this down, so I was supposed to open the podcast on that. And then forgot.
Right. Don't you worry. I've only waited 2 weeks to talk about this, so I'm cramming it in where I can.
Please do.
I went to see the Menzingers.
I've heard of them.
Newcastle.
Yeah.
They were really good.
Some of the best zingers you could find.
Absolutely.
I love them.
You know, annoyingly, not as funny as they should be.
Dad jokes.
But I was seeing this band, and then some lovely guy called Kian, who watches some of the channels, came up and we had a chat. Mm-hmm. And he asked me a question of, how did I get into doing this job to mm-hmm. begin with? And I hadn't thought about that in years.
Did we not answer that at some
really,
point?
We definitely did. Yeah, right, we've right. done it on like a chatty, but it was just, mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's been a while
anyway.
It
was a lovely little chat. It was a lovely conversation. And it got me thinking about you messaging me, well, not just me personally, but having those first conversations, getting published on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And I only bring that up to say it was a strange coincidence because I hadn't thought about that in ages. And then a few days later, my phone gave me a notification saying that it was 9 years since the first article I ever did.
When no
I
way.
So I just kind of wanted to throw that in about how long ago that was.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to tell you off because why were you letting me write at 20 years old for a website, man? That's criminal, that.
You were an active participant in the online digital space. You were available to be messaged and up for certain things. You were already writing for #crack.com.
So, I've got a confession to make about that. It's not that I swindled you. I really did write for crack.com. For those of you, I should probably explain the story now. Scott messaged the university that
I was going to say it wasn't me that recruited
at the
you.
Time. No, yeah. Scott didn't do it personally. I wasn't headhunted.
I mean, I would have done.
You put out essentially a message across the university saying that War Culture was looking for writers.
Yeah, I knew I forget the name of the dude now, but it was my lecturer from at the time because I'd left university and got hired at War Culture, and then we were building the team, and I was like, well, I want to circulate something around the because I just want people who are hungry to do this stuff.
Yeah.
And I was still in touch with my old lecturer at the time, and he was like, well, I can circulate something. So I sent him an email, and he put it out. I don't know how it got circulated, but I sent him a thing.
Pretty much just that. I think he just right. sort of sent it to, I was in the media department. I can't remember if it was more than that, but it definitely went to the media department anyway, and was saying like, you know, here's the email to send an application to. So the way I didn't get the job only because of this, but I leveraged that cracked article.
So stunning good looks, mate.
That I did write. I did not have stunning good looks then or now. But this cracked article that I wrote, I did write it. I spent months writing it. In fact, it was an arduous process trying to get something published on that website because their standards were just so high. You went through so many different editors. It was a nightmare, to be honest. It made me cry at one
right.
point. I was like broken.
Damn.
But the point is that it went up, and it does have my name on it still, I imagine, if I went to check it. And it did do really well, got like a million views. But I'm going to level with you.
Uh-huh.
90% of that article was rewritten by whoever ghost wrote it. I have never been more deflated professionally in my life than seeing that finally go up after about 6 months of graft and realizing
it's
how
all
much
rewritten.
They changed. It was brutal. It was like, it was heartbreaking, man. It was
right.
honestly guttering. And I still kind of showed it off, but I wish I could be more proud of that than I was. And I'm still proud that I did the graft and got it up.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
you know, had that experience. And I do think it was really useful experience because it made me, when I became an editor here, mm-hmm. and I was editing people's work, not do that essentially and
well, I mean,
give writers more feedback rather than just change it myself because now I knew how that felt when your words came back and they were someone else's.
No, man, it's a testament to the fact that the quality was always in you anyway. Because like if you take it from that step onwards, like you came in, we started working together, everything in the last 9 years.
Yes.
Like everything's been, we've flown since then. So there was always enough quality there. It is funny that like the, because I remember, I actually don't really remember what the emails looked like, what the text was, what the reply was, but I remember getting, we got a bunch of replies, but it was you, our own Ewan Patterson was from that thing as well. And lots of other people, but like over time it was, well, this guy works for Cracked, so like that's potentially cool. And then that eventually leading to like an in-person internship and stuff. And going from there, but yeah, I guess that was the specific one-to-one, was like a calling, what would you call it? Like a putting the cast out, putting the call out across the university and people responding to that and going from there. But like, yeah, it doesn't take anything away from what you did after that stuff.
No, of course not. I just thought it was a funny story that maybe someone can relate to.
Everyone's going to get their start somewhere.
I wanted to throw that anniversary up because I don't think I've ever even celebrated an anniversary. But no. I thought, you know what? It's 9 years since Scott and I have known each other. What better place to break that than on the wind up?
Hell yeah, man. We built this across the pandemic as well. The wind up is our own little thing. We have many other little talking points here. One of them being Witcher 3 versus Baldur's Gate 3.
Yes, this is another thing I was actually going to open the podcast on that I completely forgot about. But as you recall, Scott Telford, a few weeks ago, maybe even the last episode of the wind up, I made the audacious claim that Baldur's Gate 3 was better, or at least had a better story than The Witcher 3.
Ludicrous.
I hadn't finished Baldur's Gate at that time. I was right at the end. I was 99% complete. I've since completed Baldur's Gate 3, and I was wrong. And I can hold my hands up and say, look, I was smoking some strange stuff.
You know, you love someone so much that you're like, yeah, I'm just going to let them say this thing. They still know I love them.
I was high on my own supply, man, and I was just so confident that Baldur's Gate 3 would have at least a decent ending.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
I would say this is hilarious because you don't like the bits that I love that made that game's story, but it's still demonstrably worse than The Witcher 3 story.
This is it, right? I thought Baldur's Gate had an okay ending at best. I thought, considering that I was laughing off The Witcher 3's Ciri decisions as just being four discrete moments and saying, oh, Baldur's will do way better than that, it kind of didn't. It kind of... In a way,
it didn't do right by you.
It didn't do right by me. You know, I liked what was there. I just thought it felt very rushed compared to what I was expecting. A few things just didn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. No spoilers here. But overall, I kind of wanted to just revisit that and temper my praise for Baldur's Gate 3. I still think it's one of the best RPGs
ever made. It's unbelievable.
It's incredible. That certainly didn't like ruin my time with it. I'm barely going to think about it going forwards because the previous 90 hours were just that good.
Uh-huh.
But I would be... I can't deny that it ended on a softer note than expected it
to. Death Stranding thing. Like, sometimes a game just ends on such a bum note, such a sour note, where it's like, oh, I can't not live with this now. It was great till then, and now I've just got... I can't... Every time... Then your memory just always serves it up right next to the good stuff. I can't disconnect my... I don't know how many... 120 hours of heaven in Death Stranding for an ending that was absolute turd.
And I get it. And I get it now. You know, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. Like I said, I think it's... okay. It's not like Mass Effect 3 levels of, oh my God, I can't believe what you're doing, even though I quite like Mass Effect 3's ending.
Here he is.
But it just, I was surprised at, considering how just nicely constructed the rest of the game was, how a little bit rushed I thought the end was. And
and that's the patch. You played the one with the extended stuff
as
well.
I know, and even that didn't necessarily do it for me. I think there's a lot in Act 3 where you can tell that they were just running out of time a little bit and things were getting cut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still great. It's still better than most RPGs. It's still the best modern RPG in 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wonder what that final act would have looked like with maybe a year's more development.
I can only say that I loved the way that my ending came together. I think I was less invested in doing every... I only left like two side missions by the end of Act 3 that I didn't do. That involved Raphael and it involved Lizelle. I didn't do those quests. But the way that my game found ways to serve up story scenes and knit everything together for me anyway, to me, worked beautifully. And I love the ending that I got. I'm not going to go into spoilers. We ended up with opposite sides where you'd done every single thing to that point, and then the ending didn't really honor that in a way that it could have done, whereas it totally worked for me, who was at that point just ready for it to end.
Yeah.
Act 3 was so long. I was just like, I'm with the wing of Baldur's Gate 3 fans or players that think that game is so mismatched in its pacing and think that Act 3 is like pretty bad in regards to its pacing, although when things start coming together, it's phenomenal. And then like, to me, because you're ticking off the end of all these quests in quick succession, all these different story arcs and everything else. But that game is spinning 50 million plates at once and trying to make you look at certain ones. And
that's it, man. I think my expectations were just too high for that ending because, my biggest disappointment was I did like almost everything. If there's something big that I missed, I don't know what it is.
Right.
And my issues were just with how those side missions and those side characters were woven into the finale in a way that I felt like... I don't regret doing them because just doing them in and of themselves was joy enough, but I thought they were going to be integrated more into the finale, even like how Mass Effect 3 had its, what was it, Galactic Readiness Meter.
Yeah.
Like, I thought even that gave more purpose to those side missions than some of the stuff that was brought up in Baldur's Gate. It had great payoffs for a handful of them, but it was just a couple others that I thought were left out to dry.
That is fair. Let's argue about Mortal Kombat 1.
Oh, God, yeah, let's do it. Man, I went mad last week. I had, you know when you finish a big game and... You know, you just kind of think, well, I'm free now. Not in a bad way. I loved it.
No, but you have that grace period,
You have a grace period of, I can play anything I want. That's what I did over the past 2 weeks, especially when I was ill as well. And I thought, well, now it's time to play Mortal Kombat 1. Mm-hmm. I did it in pretty much one sitting last Wednesday while I was off. And I thought it was really good.
It's phenomenal to a point,
A lot. Up to that point that you mentioned, where I think it goes off the rails, but not for the same reasons you think, I don't think.
Oh, man, but we're going to do Mortal Kombat 1 story spoilers. Yes. I figure most of the MK fandom will have at least played the campaign. So apologies if you haven't skipped, let's say, 5-10 minutes from now. If not, it's the multiverse stuff that started sending me sideways initially, but it's the absolute FU middle finger go play the online microtransaction fest that is that terrible board game mode that made me hate the end of it.
We've not interrogated this, and I mean this in the... I'm not trying to set you up or anything, but that multiverse go play the live service insult, as it were, I just didn't feel it. Like, when I finished the campaign, I didn't like necessarily where it went towards the end, and I thought some things could have been fleshed out way more, but I didn't feel like it was incomplete in any way. You know, I felt like it was... there was a cliffhanger, but the story that had ended, I thought, made sense from where I started, and I had enough. It wasn't a Suicide Squad, put it that
way. Well, it's funny because I need to compare it. Again, apologies for, I'm going to use a phrase that relates to the end of Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League. It's not going to be very specific, but 13 Brainiacs.
Yes.
It's 13 Brainiacs applied to Mortal Kombat. Like, when you finish that story, yes, it has an ending, because somewhere in development, they obviously got told this is how it's going to go, and we needed to pivot into this online. In the Invasions mode, I think it's called Invasions, is the board game type mode. They finished the story as best they could, but to me, it's very telling that you have a whiteout ending. Like, you defeat Quan Chi and Shang Tsung, and then you have everything goes white. It feels like things are going to explode or whatever it is. And then we cut to, like, everyone's just chilling back at, like, a bar. And it's like, well, I guess all that got sorted then.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of, there's, like, a resolution. Liu Kang walks away. And then you get a pop-up, just a graphic on screen saying, like, well, there's infinite open portals everywhere. So go take care of them and go spend the rest of your days in the Invasions mode. And it's like, there's a way to do that would have felt propulsive or would have felt more deftly handled. But it's like, you have all these things in the main story that are tributing the MK series of games that was like Deadly Alliance and Armageddon and Deception. And you have all that stuff in there, apart from Onaga or... I forget the name of the dude that awakens Onaga now, but the dude in Deception. You know, you have all these things that are playing on that, and then they kind of jump past Deception to do the Armageddon ending where you're going up the temple and everything's gone to hell and whatever. It just felt so rushed in those back chapters. And It was like, well, multiverses are in, so I guess we'll do one of them, and then we can do the infinite mode. And then it was like some of the bugs and stuff, some of the platform issues that were on PC, like the game didn't seem that polished. They patched it loads since launch.
Right.
You had the microtransaction side of it where things were really overpriced, like they're charging for individual fatalities, the skin prices are really high. It just reeked of something that needed to get over the finish line from a publisher perspective.
Yeah.
And that came across in the story to me. It's not that the teams didn't do the best they could, but I resent the fact that they start out with a whole new canon and they bin it off and they bring another Shang Tsung in and they go back to, like, it's as convoluted now as it was at the end of MK11, and the whole point of rebooting was a clean slate, which was clearly denied at some point in development.
No, I agree with a lot of what you just said there. You know, I think it's definitely rushed towards the end when it does start introducing, you know, the Shang Tsung who was in Mortal Kombat 11 and won and beat Kronika in his timeline and branched it off or whatever. Like, that stuff just comes at you so fast, and then suddenly you've amassed an entire army of multiversal warriors and you're going up the Armageddon pyramid and you're fighting people, and it's like, how do we get here? This is not my beautiful wife. But I guess for me, the only difference is, while I have those criticisms for sure, I think it's just comparing it to Suicide Squad and it's 13 Brainiacs. I just think where you end in Mortal Kombat, yeah, it might be rushed, it might be a little bit anticlimactic, but I think it still respects the world that it's established. In fact, it respects it a little bit more than I thought it would by going back to that timeline and saying, no, we're going to pick up from here. We're going to go back to Kung Lao and Raiden and Liu Kang as Earthrealm's, what do you call it?
Defenders.
Defenders. And kind of go from there. Now we've wrapped up this multiversal thing that we're still hinting at. It had an ending in a way that Suicide Squad didn't. Like, right. when I finished Suicide Squad, I felt like I won't know what that story is until I do all of the padding you've attached to it, whereas I cannot touch Invasions, and I don't feel like I've missed much.
Oh, I can only fundamentally disagree. Like, it is the padding that they threw you into. I felt like the MK1 ending, like I said, to me, it didn't feel satisfying just because of how fast it cut to white and you changed the location and stuff, and the graphic popped up on screen, and I was like, oh, so is there a story scene if I go and close off all these portals? Because I thought the whole point of doing this new timeline was to have, like, this new definitive canon because of how messy MK's canon has got. You know, and they were having fun with that stuff. Like, you bring Motaro back in, and it's like, that's great. Like, you know, I love a good convoluted lore. Like, it's one of my favorite things. I love reeling off stupid facts about Lost or Metal Gear or whatever. I like knowing about a big convoluted lore. And I love Mortal Kombat's lore as well. And have been, you know, following it for as long as I can remember at this point. But if you're going to push the reset button on that, cool. I'll go with you on that story, on that journey or whatever, and I'll be with you. And the changes that they made were so, I would say, substantial. Like, you're changing, you know, entire biomes around, and you're changing, like, the power dynamics of that world. Like, you've got Adenia is so much more fleshed out with Sindel and everything. That stuff was just so purposeful, and it felt deftly handled. Like, me and my wife, I was like, you should watch this, these cutscenes, because they totally work as its own story, and we were doing that stuff. And then there was a point where I was just playing, and she was like, oh, just keep going, like, I'll catch up later. And all the multiverse stuff kicked in, and it was like, oh, that just bins off all the stakes, all the, right. the pathos, all the character work that was there before, all the stuff with, like, General Khan overthrowing Sindel, and, like, you know, all the stuff with Raiden, and can he be the next Liu Kang, and all the training, and all the stuff with Kenshi that was just kind of thrown away, and like, whatever. After a while, I was like, I don't think, like, they made it work, but it, yeah. it's, they didn't commit to the new world, and they didn't, like, do right by what the game was supposed to be. And then when you add in, like I said, some of the bug, the platform issues, the microtransactions, the infinite online mode, it just got so Warner Brothers to death.
I know, yeah.
That I just was like, what even is this at this point?
It's, yeah, it's a fascinating product, it's a fascinating game, and it's a fascinating story, because on the one hand, I agree with you. I think, you know, they should have committed to the new timeline more. On the other hand, I like that there was still a lingering multiversal aspect, because it kind of honors the end of Aftermath, where you have, like, these two specific branching timelines where you, I think you can even play as Shang Tsung, right?
You do in Aftermath, yeah.
Yeah, like, I thought that was a cool way to honor, like, the player's input in that part of the story, rather yeah. than just having to choose one thing be canon, which would have been fine, of course, if they did that, but I thought that was an interesting wrinkle to canonize the arcade nature of that ending. I thought that was neat. It had a lot of things that were, like, neat on paper. I similarly love the changes that they've made. I love what they do with Baraka in the Tarkatans. I love Sindel is awesome in this game. Yeah. Kitana's awesome. Mylena's awesome. I love the role of General Shao. Yeah. I like his new kind of subtly redesigned design as mm-hmm. well. I think generally, like, the designs of all the characters are, like, my favorite.
They're awesome, man.
More human Sub-Zero and Scorpion. I love the cleanness of their...
I like Emperor Sub-Zero from, like, Deception. And I like my hellacious Scorpion, but not with a flame skull. I just like him being all messed up. Like, this is a good starting point.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I didn't realize how much I needed a human version of those characters until I got them. And it made me look back, funnily enough, you mentioned Deception, on Deception, Sub-Zero, and Scorpion, and think, no, that was a bit too much for me.
No.
I kind of liked it dialed back a little bit. I like the cleanness of this new timeline, which I guess in essence is supposed to be more hopeful, I suppose.
Well, that was the thing, right?
Like, colorful, optimistic.
Yeah, like, you have, that's the thing you said there about, like, they honor both sides of a 50-50 split. That's it. That is cool. That's a really cool thing to do. It's just that the thing is, they didn't bring in, I'm going to forget the dude's name, the guy that played Shang Tsung in the movie that they got back to be Shang Tsung in Aftermath, which is phenomenal. He does the Your Soul Is Mine. He does all the stuff that's great. When they bring in that other Shang Tsung, it's just the same Shang Tsung twice, which is different to bringing in Chris Lambert when they bring the other Raiden in. So I'm like, do this or don't do this.
I agree with you there.
It was a bit weird.
That was a bit where I thought the scope of this game is just way too big for the time you clearly have. Mm. Because, yeah, when that Shang Tsung comes back and it is just a reskin version.
It's the new version.
Of the Shang Tsung in this timeline, right? It's like what? It's the same when you get Kitana back. Like, mm-hmm. I know they changed, I'm pretty sure they changed the face model between games again. And it's like, but that would have been more
impactful. She's changed races in decades.
Yeah. Well, that's it, right? But it would have been more impactful if it was instantly recognizable as MK11's Kitana. Mm-hmm. Like, that makes more sense than it just being a reskin version of this that we're now pretending was the previous version. That stuff was not thought out,
no,
I don't think, very well.
And I think for me, I this is a completely personal thing, but I'm done with multiverse stuff. It robs stories of stakes. Like, if anyone who dies can just come back, any retcon, anything you need to do, you can just do it in a multiversal way. And there are so few multiverse stories that actually use it as a plot device. Like, Everything Everywhere All at Once is one of the only things that does that. And, like, in Mortal Kombat's case, as soon as they pulled the multiverse trigger, it lost all stakes to the story that were there for the first, like, two-thirds to me.
What, to me, or to you, sorry, makes that, I know it's more substantial than what happened at MK11, but did you not get any of that in MK11 as well with, like, the time travel and bringing characters back? Because to me, it's the same thing in terms of what you're doing.
We're in a different time entertainment wise where multiverse stuff is like exhausted now versus how when they started doing it, MK11. MK had a better track record with time travel back then. Like you had, when they rebooted it in 2011, you had Raiden sending his consciousness back in time to relive the events of the first three games. And that was a really cool way of doing that. It kind of made it one big timeline if you go off his consciousness versus how they could have done it otherwise. And then, yeah, that was quite cool. That idea of like, I mean, they do immaculate character work with Johnny Cage.
Yeah.
Like, as a character that no one was expecting to have an emotional beat, but him learning, like, having to deal with Sonya's death and then, like, him having a daughter and realizing what it's like being a father and, like, living for someone else. Like, it's, you know, like, I think Johnny Cage is, like, Ed Boon's favorite character. I'd say him or Scorpion. And they did really good work with that. The time travel stuff meant something. Like, you had him meet his younger self and be like, oh, my God, this is how I used to be. And that's a great thematic to make a person playing that or someone who's indulging in that story. Like, what would I actually say to my younger self? I'm glad I moved on from certain things or whatever. They did just enough of that where it was like, it was just you're meeting your younger self. That's it. There's not infinite timelines. There's not infinite portals that are connected to a live service. There's just one framing device and Kronika is in charge of time. And if you kill her, that resets everything and then we're solid again. And it's like, we did all that.
Yeah.
And then they squeezed a little bit more out of that with Aftermath because then it was Shang Tsung got in charge and whatever. But then going forward, it was like I said, it was so messy. It was so convoluted. It was so fractured that like they were like, we're just going to wipe it all clean. Liu Kang has the power. He molds a reality and that's it. And I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
Let's just pick and choose what we're going to go forward with. And then they don't stick to that. They fracture it all wide open again. And it just felt so like an inversion of what they were going in with. And why it's even worth doing this.
Yeah, like what you mentioned there about Johnny Cage and the drama that you can wring out of meeting your former self. Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree with that. I think that is handled better in MK11. I suppose the only thing I was thinking about or what was sticking in my mind from MK11's time travel shenanigans was when they just bring back Liu Kang and Kung Lao, who I forgot even died, by the way. And then it's like, oh yeah, these are the main characters now. That's the kind of undoing of deaths and consequence that I suppose I was getting at, but no, you are right.
Well, the
generally
thing is, like,
it does do it better than MK1 does.
It just felt more purposeful. Like there was a purpose to resetting the timeline and letting Liu Kang be in charge as Raiden's underling who finally has the Elder God power to remake a world in the way that he thinks is best, and he mushes all these biomes together, all these different timelines, all these things that he as a character, as an individual, would think is a utopian world, and then he can't help whatever energies remain that create Shang Tsung. Like, they didn't really go into why Shang Tsung has to exist again, or why not wipe everybody out, but like whatever, like there's maybe some rules there, he has to remake everything. And it's in their blood, it's in their energy that they have to go a certain way. Like, and they tease that in the story with, like, Scorpion gets his eye scar. Hanzo Hisashi doesn't even exist in this new timeline yet.
Yeah.
He's, like, the son of Kuai Lang. But all that stuff, it's, like, that great thematics there.
You're right,
that
yeah.
whole idea of, like, it's within them. They can't be better than this. They have to do Mortal Kombat. Like, so cool, but it all just goes away because we need to do multiverse stuff.
I'll tell you what else is crap as well.
Go on.
The cameo system. I'm not going to spend too much time on it.
Forgot it was in there.
It's kind of lame. Kind of lame.
Tag fighters, other than like Tekken Tag, when it was a cool thing in 2000, not a fan.
No, I agree.
Yeah, don't really need it. Most of the thing is like, that's another thing that points to, I said before, like skip 5-10 minutes, it's probably been half an hour. The thing with my assumption that things were crunched and turned around and made to fit certain release schedules, as we read about in previous years about how they were working on Injustice, they had to go back to Mortal Kombat. The fact that they got rid of the amount of customization per character, if you directly compare it to MK11, it's a fraction of what you could do in MK11.
Yeah.
When you pick two characters to fight each other, you don't get unique meetups anymore at the start of every fight. You get one if you're in the right versus menu off the main menu. Otherwise, they just don't acknowledge each other when they fight.
Oh, really?
That's a shame. Like, that's fundamentally something that's removed. All the victory screens are the same camera angle. It's both your characters standing there. You remove the cinematics. And how unique the victory poses were in MK11 for every individual character.
Yeah.
You take all that stuff out to get it over the finish line. I can't not see that reduced version of that game.
I know, you're right, man. I mean, there's no crypt. There's no crypt one.
And it's like, yeah, like the unlock scheme is like just so threadbare. Like, feed coins to a dragon and watch the animation over and over again and hope you get something that's worthwhile. It's just a shame. Like, if you're going to do a soft reboot of a canon that is this many entries in, really fully commit to it, and they do for as much as you could. I just feel like you could see the developer versus publisher fight. And the more we read about on the Warner Brothers side, David Zaslav wanting live services in everything, you could see the tendrils towards it as that story played out.
Nah, I agree. I think it's a fine game. It was a lovely 6 hours of my life. I'm not somebody who plays fighting games long term, so I couldn't necessarily comment on whether it has the legs in the systems or the game modes to sustain itself. It seems like it's had a bit of a rocky post-launch period, but
it's been fascinating watching it roll out. Like, yeah, because the gameplay is phenomenal. It's some of the best playing MK we've ever had. There's the cameo stuff and how much you get stuck in the air and everything. That's a you can argue is an issue, but yeah, like it's the microtransaction stuff. The community response over time has been pretty naff.
I know it's going to be interesting where they go from here because, yeah, you can sort of see WB's tendrils get into this franchise more and more with every new release.
Play Tekken 8. Tekken 8 is the best
Boy, I've got the demo. Can you believe that?
You're not going to play it, though.
I played a demo.
What?
I know.
Why didn't you tell me this first?
I needed to know. Because I haven't bought the game, so I have nothing else to add. Oh! But it looked really good.
Yeah.
Why is it 70 quid? I mean, I know why it's 70 quid, but I can't afford 70 quid.
Stop buying Rick Grimes skins or planning to buy Michonne. Yeah, Tekken 8 and Street Fighter 6 demonstrably better, I would say, as packages than MK1. How much time have we got left? I'm leaving this thing in. We've almost hit an hour. We've got many plot points
have
to keep
we?
Going.
Let me quickly run through. I'll tell you what. I'll save Silent Hill, because that's going to be substantial.
Yep.
But let me wax lyrical about VR.
And please
don't. Don't press off this podcast, because I've mentioned the words VR. I promise it's
interesting. I'll tell you what, right? We'll do a couple of VR things, because you lived on VR for most of last week, and then we'll talk a little bit about Tomb Raider Remastered. Tell me about this bed we made.
Oh, my God, I forgot about that as well. Yeah, we've got so much to talk about.
Yeah.
This bed we made, what a lovely surprise this has been. Played it, a little bit of it, with my partner because it was Valentine's Day and I thought, oh, we could go for a nice little indie game.
We ate a big cookie.
Did you really?
We got a really big cookie and we ate it.
I love a big cookie.
Yeah.
Did you get it from Millie's Cookies?
We did, yeah. Shout out to Millie's Cookies, giant cookies. Nice, I wanted it? Two. Mine was gone. My half was gone in about 10 minutes.
Was it?
If that, to be honest, like 10 seconds. I want more.
The beauty of my partner is she doesn't like sweet things too much. So if I get something like a Millie's cookie, I know that she'll eat like a bite and then the rest is mine.
Oh,
so I can enjoy that.
Just give me the large cookie for the rest
good,
of my
aren't
life.
They? They're really nice, aren't they? I was unfortunately ill, violently ill during our Valentine's Day. But we got this game called This Bed We Made. And it's a kind of L.A. Noir-like where you play as a, I want to say 1950s, hotel maid, so you're the cleaner, and it's third person, over the shoulder, semi-realistic graphical style, and you have to solve a mystery, essentially. So you, the only gameplay in there is solving puzzles and cleaning. So it opens up, you're in a room, you clean the room, you go downstairs, you're assigned to this other room, 505, I think it is, and you go in.
You're in VR.
No, this isn't VR.
Oh.
This is normal.
I thought this was JB's VR section.
No. Well, I thought so too. Then I forgot I even put this down.
Oh.
This is not. This is just a regular game.
I get you.
Third person plays like L.A. Noir. And you go into room 505 as this maid called, I think she's called Sophie, and you see pictures of yourself. So whoever's in this room has been snooping on you. Mm. They've got them up, and there's like a kind of conspiracy board on the wall. And it's just about being in this hotel, and it's about unraveling this mystery. Okay. I'm not to the end of it yet, so I can't say if that mystery is going to be cool or worth it in the long run. But it's, from what I can gather, about 5 hours of gameplay. Mm. And it is, it's had some nice puzzles so far. The dialogue is pretty solid. I like the interactions between the hotel staff and the different dynamics that they have. And it's just one of those nice little surprises. I think it was only about £25 because it is shorter. Mm-hmm. And it has, you know, it has some of those rough around the edges moments when it comes to animations and whatnot. But I think if you liked something like L.A. Noir and your expectations were in check, it's a really nice time because the puzzles are interesting and I'm excited to see where the narrative actually goes. And it has branching pathways as well. You get to make decisions. We're not sponsored by it or anything, nothing like that. I just think it's really neat. It's
can you,
thing that I like.
Can you pick stuff up and then rotate it slowly?
You can do a little bit of that.
Get in.
You can also make the bed, pick pillows up off the floor, snoop in people's drawers.
I don't want to do that.
I do.
I want to see doggy
what
dog.
These people from the 60s are up to. Mm. I think if you, I know I keep saying it, if you like L.A. Noir, but if you like Mad Men, it gives me a real Mad Men vibe.
Okay.
I'm half expecting one of these hotel tenants to be Don Draper and in disguise or something. It's cool, man. It's cool.
How did you find this thing?
My beautiful habit of just going on the PlayStation Store and seeing what's there.
Interesting.
And it was one of those things where I saw
I love
it.
One games journalist says to another, how do you find these games?
How do you find the
games, mate?
Nah, man, again, it's all my partner. She'll point at a bit of cover art, and then I'll stop and I'll go, ooh, that sounds really good.
Because you've stay out the house last year, which I would never even know existed if it wasn't for you.
The exact same way, man. Sometimes you just got to take a stroll through the new releases and see what's there. And sometimes, like, is it Banishers of New Eden? Suddenly things that weren't on my radar are now on my radar. Doesn't always pay off. Sometimes you get some crap, but sometimes you get something good in that you otherwise... I just, like, there was no reviews for this.
No.
I think I saw one from, I think it was PC Gamer, which was a good review, but there was just nothing out there about it. And
I think I'd seen the logo or the artwork for it. When you mentioned this morning we were going to be talking about it on the pod, it did ring a bell.
Yeah.
But I'm entirely underwater with Infinite Wealth.
Yes,
I need to get through it. I'm like 15 hours into that game. It's incredible and I love it, but I'm determined to get through that before Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, because that'll be my march. So yeah.
This is it. This is why I've gone mad, right? Because there's only huge games now. You know, coming off Baldur's Gate with Final Fantasy on the horizon, I knew that would be another hefty chunk of time, so I just wanted something short, and that's why I went to Foam Stars, and I went to this bed we made, and one of those proved much better than the other.
You should tell me about Creed Rise to Glory while we're on.
Yeah, I know, I've really overtaken this podcast, bloated it out to extreme length.
It's gotta be done.
Let me talk to you about Creed Rise to Glory, which is a VR game, a VR boxing game, if you couldn't tell by the title, Creed, of course, being the spin-off to Rocky, and essentially, man, it's VR boxing. And I thought, how good could this be? It turns out it can be amazing. And yes. I'll be truthful. The reason that I bought this game in the first place wasn't because I wanted a boxing game. It's because I suck at cardio. Okay. And I've been trying to get back to...
You want to get the Ring Fit, mate?
Oh, I got one.
It's so good.
I was crap at that as well. It did nothing for me, the Ring Fit. But
I love Ring Fit.
I've been trying to, like I said at the start of this podcast 5 hours ago, I've been trying to get back into my gym routine.
Yeah.
And I've managed to do that more or less with
Jim Ryan.
Jim Ryan, right?
Very good.
Call me Jim Ryan. with the weights, because I find weights just all right to do. But there's something about cardio that I just find boring, man.
Yeah,
like,
man.
I don't like doing it. I don't like being sweaty.
Same.
So that's not very good. And I can't look at half an hour after work and being taken up by just walking. And even if I'm like listening to a podcast, my brain just rejects it.
I know what you mean.
It says, get home.
Walking is the drinking water of exercise.
It is.
And I love drinking water.
Same. I wouldn't even put it on the same level. It's like...
You know, some people just don't like water, though.
Yeah,
and
I do.
Like, what are you doing?
What is the best drink?
It's like drinking the idea of being refreshed.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like drinking a reset. It's
sorry
beautiful.
For wanting to be hydrated. Bloody hell. So essentially, I've been trying to find cheat codes for months to get me to do some cardio. And I thought, wait, maybe. Maybe boxing. Because I've always wanted to hit the bag, as it were, anyway. But I just don't have the equipment for it, and I don't want to go and see other people to get trained or anything. So I just thought, you know what, I'll see if this works. Anyway, the point is, it really works. In fact, I'm doing more cardio now through this VR thing than I ever was when I was actually doing the gym.
That's good.
To what I was supposed to be doing there. Mm-hmm. And it's just really fun. My only comparison for this game was Wii Boxing, which is so out of date, because all you're doing is swinging the
2009,
nunchucks.
2007,
and you're swinging the nunchucks and you're not moving your body. Yeah. Obviously, in VR, you've got this thing strapped to your head, so you're ducking, you're diving, you're weaving, you're on your toes, you're throwing jabs, and it is intense when these hulking dudes are coming towards you. And obviously, you're not feeling the punches, but your brain still kind of tricks you into, you know, flinching or feeling like someone is all up in your grill, all up in your space. Mm-hmm. And I've had such a fun time doing it. I've looked like a state doing it. I've sent you some images and some videos that should never be circulated
online.
It's just
the future of that. I feel like everyone's going to be like that.
Yep, of me in my pants with the headset on, sweating. Absolutely.
It's very
sweating.
This is what peak performance looks like.
This is what it really is, you know. You don't have to like it, but this is,
because I was like, who's filming this? It's like it's a locked off shot. I was like, is your partner filming this? This yourself?
My girlfriend got some sneaky videos while she was in the kitchen of unbeknownst to me and me pants doing this game, but it's a whole lot of fun.
And, yeah,
it's interesting to get better at something that's physical. Like we we get better in games all the time, and it's satisfying. But to physically get better, to get better at this boxing game by stringing together jabs more or having more awareness of what your opponent is going to do, it's obviously not the real thing, but it feels satisfying in a way that it you can't just when you're playing the game. And it got me just thinking about VR, because I've also been playing The Walking Dead Sinners 2 after buying it last year. And it got me thinking about, you know, when you always talk about, like, when's the next gameplay innovation coming? I'm not saying this to try and get you to play a bloody VR too, but I think it's in these games. Like, I was having moments similar to maybe how you were having them in Helldivers 2 in Saints and Sinners, where I just thought, this is what games can be. This has given me a sense of experimentation and freedom that I don't really have on the flat screen anymore.
Oh, true, yeah.
Like, for instance, Saints and Sinners 2, which is a zombie survival game, if you don't know, introduces night missions where, kind of like how in Dying Light, when it gets to nighttime, the zombies are stronger, you're not supposed to be out. That's kind of how the first game worked as well. This time around, you can go out at night and it's more viable, but obviously there's way more zombies. It's harder to get around. It's going to be harder to extract yourself. There's even more humans with guns and stuff. So I was in this mission where I had to infiltrate a school, and there's so many zombies and there's so many people with guns, and I died.
Right.
When I was really deep into the level, and it also has this Dark Souls style system where your backpack with all your stuff will be where your dead body is, and you don't get it, because if you die again, you lose all that stuff. So you spawn in, right, with only what you had on your body when you died. Mm-hmm. All I had on my body when I died was a bow and arrow with 4 arrows,
right,
and I think that was literally it. So I'm faced with this idea, Scott, of going back into this school a fraction of the equipment that I had, because I didn't want to lose that equipment, because I had some good guns, I had some good resources to bring back to camp and stuff. So I thought, how am I going to do this? There's nothing in the area, I've exhausted it. And I had one of those VR moments that just made me feel like a genius, where I was drawing back the string on the bow. And I realized I had to manually load the bow with the arrow, right? Mm-hmm. So one hand I have the bow, one hand I have the arrow. And I just thought, well, instead of drawing it back, can
just
I not just
stab him?
Yeah, can I just use this as a weapon? And I thought, will the game let me do that?
Yeah.
So I took it in one hand, and because it's like so thin and so unlike the other weapons I was using, I didn't know if I'd even be able to get the power on it, because you need to, like, properly, you know, swing around to make sure you penetrate the zombie flesh. So I give it a go at this zombie that's coming towards me, and I miss, right?
Right.
And I stab him in the stomach, and I'm like, oh my God. So I'm holding
this. If the game recognized the stab, though.
It did. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? It did recognize it. So I thought, whoa, on the one hand, now I need to get rid of this zombie who's, you know, plunging towards me while I've stabbed him in the stomach. But two, this could work. So I pulled it out. Second attempt, straight in the noggin, right? Straight through the eyeball. And I thought, this is going to be amazing. This is how it works. I pulled the arrow out, and then suddenly I'm crawling through this school, just stabbing people with this improvised weapon.
Like Legolas when he puts the arrow through the orc.
And I was learning, like, a new mechanic as I went, because I realized, you know, after a few kills, if I hold the arrow further on down my hand, like, I have better grip, so I was getting better at it. And then I got to the end of the level, and I'd run out of arrows, and I could see my backpack, and there was one zombie between us, and I thought, well, I've got no arrows left. So I found a bottle on the side, I smashed it, so it was sharp.
Did you know you could do that?
No. And then I just rammed it through the zombie's head, and then got my backpack back.
Damn.
And it was just one of those 10 minutes of gameplay that I've belabored over here that just had that improvisation and that sense of experimentation with mechanics that I think gaming just is made for.
Dude, man. Yeah, that's the gameplay forward. I'm just going to say this. That's why the cutscene, high production, earlobe stuff doesn't matter. Like, ultimately, I would have a million more experiences like that you just described than, like, oh, if you shoot the bow, it slowly sinks or whatever. the gameplay forward stuff is why I'm here. I'll go watch a movie if I want to watch a movie. But yeah, that sounds awesome, though. Like, improvising on the fly and having it pay off is the best.
I think it's the best horror game I've ever played, man. Like,
right.
Sometimes when those games click like that, I just think, oh, yeah, this is why I paid £500 for this headset, you know what I mean? Because I'm just experiencing what should be a rote gameplay section. I mean, how many times in across the generations have we infiltrated a zombie-infested school? We've done it millions of times to get an item, but it's just, it was revolutionized it had that gameplay focus that you said.
Well, it's like thinking of, like, I've done zombie escape rooms and I've done zombie chases, like, through our own Newcastle upon Tyne in the northeast of England, where you go to different buildings that are, like, laid out. And I remember when I was doing them in real life, like, I started thinking like a video game where I was like, well, I wonder what area they're allowed to, how far are they allowed to chase me? And then, like, activating different pockets of them and, like, throwing distractions and whatever. And it's like, you start thinking in that hybrid way of, like, well, I have all these lessons from gaming, but I mean, it's me doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, a VR version of a zombie thing would, even the simplest of scenarios, like, you have to actually survive it yourself, which is a massive step up.
Like, just ask a game, will you let me do this, and then it surprisingly answers yes. I mean, that's entirely what Breath of the Wild is built on. Tears of the Kingdom, just that idea of the game encouraging you to be a bit cheeky, think outside the box, and then rewarding you for it. The best games, in terms of gameplay, I feel, do that. Even something as simple, man, as when Uncharted 4 was shown off, and they were showing off the winch mechanic, and instead of going up to a tree and pressing square for the animation to begin to wrap it around, you just walked around the tree. That kind of, like, weird common sense gameplay, I guess I would... The only way I can describe it as is just so satisfying when it's done right.
It's the absolute heart of the gameplay forward argument. Yeah. If there's an argument that needs to be made, it's like letting you know that the rules work. Like the whole thing in Zelda and Tears or Breath of the Wild, where it's like, oh, there's like a bit of raw meat, but there's a flame, and if I put it next to it, it cooks the meat or whatever. That stuff can be at the heart of some of the best gameplay experiences. Anyway, we have gone for over an hour, Josh Brown.
I'm so sorry. It's my fault. I've given us the most meandering, indulgent podcast we've ever done.
It's got to be done. Headline: podcaster apologizes for podcasting. It's got to be done. I'm going to play a lot more of Tomb Raider Remastered. I've only got it downloaded, but we're going to do a bit more of a chat on the state of, I guess, the approach to remasters and the fact that Tomb Raider Remastered does it the same way as Halo Master Chief Collection and the remake of Alex Kidd. I couldn't think of any other games that have done the one button toggle to old graphics, but the Alex Kidd remake did.
Every game should do it. I'm definitely going to talk about that. Nah, man, I don't even care if you can't. Make it happen.
I'll do it with old blocky Spyro, but we'll get back around to that stuff. For now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Have a lovely week, and we'll catch you soon.
Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.